morning. We have with us this morning, as part of our award-winning court class program, students from Pius 11 of Milwaukee. Would they please stand? Well, welcome. You may be seated. And we have students from New Holstein High School. Would you please stand? And welcome to you, too. You may be seated.
That's the same title as Holstein.
Who was changed by court rule.
I didn't get the rule.
Now that you've been introduced to us, I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. To his left is Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left is Justice Patrick Crux. And with those introductions made, the other announcement I have to tell you is that Justice Babbage will meet with you all soon after the completion of the second argument here, and you will be joined by students from Hillsborough High School. So we're ready to call 96-3151 J.L. Phillips & Associates versus E&H Plastic Corporation. Ms. Lazar, you represent E&H Plastic Corporation. And before you proceed, I announce on behalf of the court that we received a letter brief from the plaintiff respondent, but that letter brief did not comply with the court rules of either a supplemental brief in accordance with the order or the instructions that materials, citations that are found subsequent to a briefing may be placed before the court. So rather than you spend your time, if you are going to spend any time in terms of the letter brief, the court will strike that brief or will not accept it.
Thank you. This case is before the court on two issues that were certified by the Court of Appeals. The first issue is the mere allegation in a proper answer of a defense known in law sufficient to constitute a meritorious defense as required by the law of default judgments? And the second issue is, if not, what is the standard for a meritorious defense? The appellant respectfully suggests that the response to issue number one is yes. An arguable defense at law in a proper answer is sufficient to constitute a meritorious defense. And we base that assertion on four key points and reasons. First, that a motion to vacate a default judgment comes at the threshold level of litigation, and the standard of scrutiny at that time should not be as high as that required for a motion for summary judgment, which comes later in litigation. The second reason is that the prior statute's requirement of an affidavit and a verified answer is no longer necessary or required. The third is that interpretations presented by Wisconsin and federal case law, which interprets the analogous federal rule, concur with the definition that an arguable defense is sufficient to constitute a meritorious defense. And the fourth is that there's a proper order of litigation and that a defendant should not be required to prove its defense completely at that start of the case. Keep bearing this in mind, we respectfully suggest that the court determined that the standard is that an arguable defense known at law is a meritorious defense, and that it vacate the default judgment in this matter, deem the answer that the appellant filed with its motion to vacate the default judgment as filed, and remand the matter to the court for further proceedings.
Your position is the answer on its face set forth arguable defenses, and that was all you had to do. You didn't have to prove any facts or give any indication.
Exactly. And the reason that we base
that... Bare-bone answer.
Excuse me?
A bare-bone answer. As long as it's not frivolous, will suffice.
Yes.
Ms. Lazar, let me ask you, in this particular situation, you did file, as I understand it, on behalf of your client, a motion to set aside the default judgment. Were there some affidavits filed in support of that motion?
There were affidavits filed in support of that motion which dealt more with the issue of excusable neglect than they did with the issue of the meritorious defense.
Did they support some of the defenses set forth in your proposed answer?
Yes, the affidavit of Peter Hylett indicated that he had one of the defenses is that the wrong party was named or that there was a mistake. Recreational products and E&H Plastic are both interrelated companies, and they have the same president.
Which affidavit was that, and is it in your appendix?
No, it is not. That's
okay.
The affidavit.
One in your appendix does not support anything other than, as I remember reading it, doesn't support anything other than excusable neglect.
Is the other affidavit the president of J.L. Phillips? Do you remember?
The other affidavit is, yes, the president of J.L. Phillips, and that was Phillips. That was filed by the plaintiff respondent.
But you did file an affidavit, you're telling us, that is part of the record, but is apparently not part of the record before this court at this point?
It is part of the record. It is not part of the appendix.
Okay.
It's either Exhibit A or Exhibit B to my memorandum in support of my motion to vacate the default judgment. I can tell you.
And that was before the trial court, when the trial court was determining whether or not there was a meritorious defense.
Yes, it was. We filed a motion with a memo. We filed an affidavit of the attorney in Chicago who had started the case and had negotiated with the counsel in Wisconsin. And we filed an affidavit of the president of both E&H Plastic, the defendant appellant, and Recreational Products, Peter Hylett. And we also filed a proposed answer. All three of those documents were attached to the memorandum of law and were before the court and were considered by the trial court. And he looked at those affidavits as well as the affidavit filed by the defendant, respondent, and went to the merits of the case and determined that he did not believe that our affidavit was sufficient.
The affidavit of Mr. Hylock, did that get to the question of whether or not the correct defendant had been named?
It raised the point that he was the president of both of them, and it gave some facts which supported that defense. It did not go in elaborate details about that defense. In support of our first contention that this is a threshold level of litigation, we contend that this is before there's any discovery in a case, and that complaints can come in several different types. For example, a very simple case like this, a breach of contract, or you could have a very complex case such as something under the Wisconsin Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Now, with a simple breach of contract case, a proposed answer to fall under the standard that we're supporting could be as simple as there was no contract, or, as we contend, one of our defenses, that the contract was breached by the other party. That should be sufficient in a proposed answer to support the standard that we're arguing. Otherwise, you're going to have move-ins under this statute have to supply extensive affidavits, do extensive discovery, and time is of the essence when you have a motion to vacate a default judgment because you only have 1 year, and all of the cases indicate that speed in responding to the finding of a default judgment is considered by the court.
It's my understanding that some federal courts, however, have, under the federal rule, have required that there be some showing of a meritorious defense. Is that right?
Yes. Some federal cases do say that. There's a split in some of the circuits. Some of the cases that we've cited in our brief say that if you have a hint of a suggestion of a meritorious defense, that's sufficient. Other cases have said this is not a motion for summary judgment, and you should not have to prove at that level. And there's also cases that just say if you have an arguable defense, that's sufficient. And those cases fall in line with the Wisconsin cases, although there's a split in the Wisconsin cases. But some of the more cases on point is Ubell versus Rosen, which says that even if the substantial defense is attacked by the other side as being a sham, the court should permit its presentation, and they're compelled to assume that the defense is offered in good faith.
Let me proceed with that.
Let's say auto accident. I'm defense attorney. I get a complaint. I have nothing more than the complaint, no investigative file, and my time's up to respond. So I, you know, deny all of the allegations, and then on defenses, I, of course, put number one, contributory negligence of the plaintiff, number two, failure to mitigate damages, number three, seatbelt defense. And sign my name, and that's it. I made it within the requisite time and have it filed. Let's say the facts of the case, once I get the police report, are that certainly everyone had their seatbelt on. Are the words seatbelt defense in that answer a meritorious defense?
Considering that you're in the early stages of litigation, there is always the obligation on the attorney or the party who's signing the answer to investigate, and I would say that they should have done or made reasonable inquiry, but if there is no time to make the reasonable inquiry, that defense should be arguably enough to support reopening a default judgment. If it is not a valid defense, then the plaintiff may make a motion to dismiss, motion for judgment on the pleadings, or after discovery, do a motion for summary judgment.
So even if the three words, seat belt defense, have no touch with reality, you want this court to find that that would be a sufficient meritorious defense.
If the rest of the answer has general denials, and I think that we argue that even if the answer did not have an affirmative defense, if it just had general denials, that should be sufficient. This bodes in line with the public policy of affording litigants their day in court.
Doesn't that mean then the word meritorious is superfluous? If you're saying all you need in an answer is denials and that would constitute a meritorious defense, I submit that just denials in an answer constitutes a defense, but what makes it meritorious?
Well, it depends on the case. The court is allowed to do some examination of the complaint and the answer. And like my first example, which was a breach of contract, what if the defense, and it's a perfectly valid defense, and that there was no contract, and the defendant argues there was no contract. That's my defense. Or if the defense is it was breached, and that's what they put down, the defense, the contract was breached by the other party. That should be sufficient to bring this case back before the court to have a full examination of the merits of the case in the context of a summary judgment motion or a motion to dismiss.
Well, what do you think the most stringent cases would say? Wouldn't they say that you should have an affidavit that says there was no contract because there was no meeting of the minds, or there's no contract because it's required to be in writing and it wasn't signed, or no contract because, or whatever.
Right now, the way that the cases stand are that the proposed answer is sufficient on its own. The statute before, when it was 269, indicated that you needed an affidavit, but that language was expressly excluded when the statute was repealed and renumbered and made into 80607.
Well, what about the Dujanski case, which was subsequent to the repeal of that, to the change in the statute? Doesn't it require something more than just an answer, denial, stated defense?
The Dujanski case was interesting in that even though the case was after the statute was changed, it made total references throughout the whole case to the old statute and had one reference in a footnote to the new statute and said that the new statute, 80607, is similar or the same to 269. And we contend that is not the case. Had the legislature wanted there to be a verified answer, which doesn't exist anymore, or an affidavit, they should have included that language and kept that language in 80607.
Well, you know, the certification by the Court of Appeals says that they think Dugensky is good law.
Right. Dugensky is good law. You do need a meritorious defense, and that's what we were reading Dugensky as.
Well, why do you need a meritorious defense? That's not what 80607 says.
Well, there's competing interests in that you don't want the parties to just be able to walk in and waste the court's time with a case that is going nowhere, which is why you do need an arguable defense at law. and you do need someone to put in a proposed answer. There are some cases in Wisconsin where the parties don't even put in any proposed answer at all, and the courts have indicated that they find that to indicate there was no meritorious defense.
Well, here the trial judge found the late response by you or your client to be excusable neglect.
Yes.
You think even then there has to be a meritorious defense to accompany that finding?
We had argued that if the court found excusable neglect, that that was where they exercised their discretion and that there did not have to be a meritorious defense. The Court of Appeals contended and certified the issues that there does have to be a meritorious defense. So therefore, the arguments the appellant is making now is that the proposed answer we've submitted, which has general denials and affirmative defenses, does constitute a meritorious defense. But we are looking also to establishing the definition of a meritorious defense. And we were contending that if you put in an arguable defense at law, that should be sufficient.
Let me ask you, I'm trying to find somewhere something to hang our hats on, so to speak, as to define meritorious defense. And one of the things I took a look at is the frivolous statute, the frivolous attorney's fees. And certainly the language in that statute, in 814, talks about not advancing an argument in law or fact that is without reasonable basis and so on. And the words meritorious claim is not there. I also looked at Supreme Court Rule 20.3.1, which is the ethical obligations of a lawyer. And I note that heading actually is meritorious claims and contentions. And that provision requires in part that in representing a client, a lawyer shall not knowingly advance a factual position unless there's a basis for doing so that is not frivolous. So it seems to key back into the frivolous attorney's fees. What I hear you saying, and it's a long way to ask the question, is that it's your position that if a lawyer in good faith, ethically, not frivolously, sets forth a denial in a answer or asserts some affirmative defenses, that that's sufficient, that is meritorious?
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
I have a question. I'm confused. I thought, based upon your brief, that your first line of argument in this case was that we no longer require a meritorious defense. And your second line was that if we still continue to require a meritorious defense, the answers that you provided were sufficient.
Yes, that was our argument in the brief, but the Court of Appeals certified two other issues to this court, and we were dealing with the issues that they certified and the fact that they've determined that there is a requirement that a meritorious defense be...
Well, are you abandoning the argument that we no longer require a meritorious defense?
We still submit that to the court for its consideration, but we recognize that there's a public policy argument that bodes in favor of finding that there be more than just the excusable neglect and that there be meritorious defense. We also contend, however, as we said in our second point, that we did submit a meritorious defense.
And all you need is an answer. And an answer even with a denial is adequate. And all you need, according to your argument, if I've got it right, is that it's a bare-bone response, answer, that is not on its face frivolous.
Yes.
So, getting back to the first argument that you seem to be abandoning, even though you say you aren't, I'm not sure that you should be. And the language of the statute is very clear. I don't want to make your arguments for you.
Well, the reason we didn't, I'm not arguing that now and that we haven't brought it up is that the Court of Appeals determined that Duginsky was good law, is still good law.
We can overturn Duginsky.
Yes, you could. And the other argument is that if you look at the statute and you look at the Federal Rule 60B, that also does not include meritorious defense, and we base a lot of our argument on federal cases which talk about a meritorious defense. So we believe that there should be...
Well, are you standing on your brief that you filed with the Court of Appeals?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to say anything more about your first argument, the first issue?
Well,
I thought it had some merit.
Our first argument and our first issue was that there's a level for the court to find excusable. There's a level for the court to exercise its discretion. And in that regard, the court can determine whether the movement falls within any of the issues of the statute, any of the areas of the statute, one of them being excusable neglect. If the court determines that there is no excusable neglect, then you don't go any further.
But we've got a case in which the court did determine that there was excusable neglect.
Right.
And that issue is not before us.
We were saying that on the face of the statute, once the court found excusable neglect and exercised its discretion, then under the statute, there should be a vacation of the default judgment.
Absolutely. Even if you don't file an answer.
That was our first argument.
That if you can get over the hurdle of inexcusable neglect, you're home free.
Right, then you would arguably have time by the court in which to file a proposed answer, and if you did not, or to file an answer, and if you did not file the answer within the time given by the court, then you would obviously lose your case.
Are there any cases other than the Dubinsky case that are contrary to that? Has anything been decided since 1977?
There are cases since 1977, and the cases since 1977 all refer back to Dubinsky.
They all rely on...
You don't have a Wisconsin case. I'll ask it differently. You don't have a Wisconsin case that says what your brief says, namely, inexcusable neglect, that's the end of the game.
No, I do not.
The cases in Wisconsin, as I understand them, are that you do have to show meritorious defense, but that they're not consistent or fully developed in a consistent manner as to what is a meritorious defense.
Exactly. And all of those cases rely back on Dubinsky, which relies back on the old statute and makes only the passing reference to the new statute.
Tell us, if you would, let's just assume for the moment that your first line of attack, that is, you don't need a meritorious defense. Let's assume you do. What would you view? I'm going to ask the same question to opposing counsel, and you can just restate it. You've stated it a number of times. What do you view as a meritorious defense? What's the definition you'd like our court to write?
I would like the court to say that under the statute 80607, I would like the court to say in a motion for it to vacate a default judgment, a meritorious defense is that an arguable defense at law set forth in a proposed answer which complies with the statutes. And in that regard, when you add complies with the statutes, you've included the fact that the attorney who signs the answer has to comply with the statutes as to signing the answer, making reasonable inquiry as to what they're saying, and is subject to the frivolous statute if they do not comply with the...
Can you further mold that definition by defining what it is not? I presume, for instance, you assume that a meritorious defense does not necessarily mean that it is one that will prevail.
Yes.
Any other ways you can define by what it is not?
It is not one that the court believes has no likelihood of success on the merits, because this is an early stage of litigation and the court should not be looking to who will or will not prevail. It should just be the question of whether or not the defense is a defense good at law.
An arguable defense would not be one where the judge would grant motion on the pleadings.
Correct.
Ms. Lazar, I know it's in your brief, but will you tell us what the defenses were that were set forth in your proposed answer?
Yes, I will. There were five defenses: failure to mitigate, improper party defendant, mistake as to the signing of the contract by the name of the president of the wrong company, estoppel due to the filing in bankruptcy court, and a breach of contract by the plaintiff in that the goods that were supplied did not work. And each of those defenses, in the affirmative defenses, are spelled out in a paragraph, most of them with more than one sentence, so there is some more than bare-bone comments added there.
Counsel, when you give arguable defense, I think it's arguable defense at law, and I noticed that you consistently said at law, when you're talking about arguable, do you mean that the facts of the defense are arguable, or do you mean that it is arguably a legal defense? It's a recognized legal defense.
Which of two do you mean?
I mean the latter.
So all you need, you don't need, then, any facts from what you're saying. You don't need to supplement anything. All you need, under your definition, is a arguably recognized legal defense. Not that the facts of defense are debatable or arguable, right?
So, correct.
As we've said before, failure to mitigate will be, under your definition, a meritorious defense because it's one recognized at law, regardless of that it has anything to do with the facts of the case. Is that correct?
Correct.
And failure to wear seatbelts is an recognized defense in the law, even if it is a contract case. Now, how do you get around that?
Well, the arguable defense at law, I would then add to my definition that it has to have some application to the issues in the complaint. You can't have an arguable defense at law. A trade secrets case, you can't say, well, there was a breach of contract. It doesn't apply at all. It is an arguable defense at law, but it has to have some application.
Have some factual merit.
Yes.
What extent of factual merit does there have to be shown in order for it to be a meritorious defense?
The mere hint of a suggestion.
Now you're going to a different, what case was it that had that? The Hampshire case?
Hold on 1 second. I can see. That was in the federal courts. That was,
the hint of a suggestion
was in the Fifth Circuit.
Mosley
Corp versus A.B. Stubbs, 410 F. 2nd, 351.
Give me the name again, please.
Moldwood, M-O-L-D-W-O-O-D, Corp. versus A.B. Stubbs, 410 F. 2nd, 351, Fifth Circuit, 1969.
I didn't read that case. Tell me. I'll ask.
Thank you.
Counsel, do you want to answer the justice's question? No. Okay. Thank you. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Werg, representing the plaintiff respondent, Phillips and Associates.
Thank you. I would like to point out at the beginning that the affidavits in support of the motion for default judgment filed by the defendant appellant are part of the record at record document 11. There are 48 pages in that document. And the affidavit of the president of E&H Plastics states no single reason for a defense. It is solely, Mr. Heilig's affidavit solely refers to the communication that he made with J.L. Phillips and that his lawyer made with J.L. Phillips. There is not one statement in Heilig's affidavit that asserts a defect in the product, that asserts a defense, or that states that there's another company that should have been sued. The same is true in the affidavit of his attorney, Mr. Howell. That also appears in Record Doc 11 in those documents. Mr. Howell recites in his affidavit the attempts that he made in submitting financial information, unaudited financial statements to myself and my client, showing that we would succeed in nothing by getting judgment against E&H Plastics, that they were uncollectible, that they were judgment-proof, and that each document that he forwarded to me or to my client, which appears also in that record, Doc 11, shows the financial status unaudited, unsigned by his client, and unacceptable to my client. And on July 15th, some 6 weeks after we had filed our summons and complaint, without any response, without any notice of retainer, I faxed a letter on July 15th saying, we're not satisfied with the information that we have received. We're going to proceed to judgment in 7 days. And we had no response. The only reference to the facts of the case came from Mr. Phillips himself. His affidavit also appears in that same document number 11. Phillips says the reason why he asked E&H Plastics president to sign an order for delivery of these products was that he was concerned about the financial status of its sister corporation. Mr. Phillips' affidavit says that E&H Plastics and this other recreational products corporation were both presidented by Mr. Hyland. He was the owner-operated, and they sometimes their business got intertwined. Mr. Phillips says in his affidavit he wasn't satisfied from the financial information that they sent to him with respect to E&H, and that's why he authorized proceeding. But if you look at the complaint has a one-page contract for order, which bears the signature of Jack Phillips, president of J.L. Phillips, and bears the signature of Peter Hylick, president of E&H Plastics. It's bold print, spelled right out there. And that's attached to the complaint. I think that the Oldwood case that was cited before you needs to be read completely. The Moldwood case talks about a hint of a defense, but then it goes on to say, it is universally recognized as an essential to the obtaining of relief from a default judgment that there should appear in the motion a clear and specific statement showing, not by conclusion, but by definite recitation of facts, that an injustice has probably been done and that the debt or demand was not owing and that there was a valid defense to it.
What case was that again, sir?
Moldwood.
It's cited in the brief?
It's cited in the appellant's brief. It's 410 Fed Second 351, Moldwood versus A.B. Stutz. And the quotation says that there was a valid defense to it and that on another trial there will be, in reasonable probability, a different result.
That's a pretty tough standard.
That's a pretty tough standard, yes.
Is that the one you're requesting?
Yes.
And why do you want to make it so tough? I mean, it's like a trial without witnesses and probably on paper rather than bringing in witnesses, right?
Well, we have a judicial decision in between the answer and the complaint.
You've got a default judgment.
That's right, but a judge made that decision after hearing also the motion to vacate. Maybe this is a poor example, but it occurred to me that when my children had a curfew that was 11 o'clock at night, and they came in at 10 minutes to 11, or a quarter of 11, or even at 11, I probably didn't ask many questions. But when they came in at 10 after, or quarter after, or 11:30, they were in default. And I asked a lot of questions. And I think the standard can be harsher under those circumstances.
That probably respond excusable neglect then.
Well, Mr. Worth, let me ask you this question. Let's assume we were writing on a clean slate We didn't have the we didn't have the 1974 statute in front of us. We didn't have Pagansky in front of us or any of its progeny. All we had was the word of the statute that we presently are working with that does not on its face require a meritorious defense. Correct? You understand the...
Yes.
And you, now you come and stand before us and you want to argue that it should require a meritorious defense, notwithstanding the statutory silence. What kind of public policy arguments would you make to try to persuade us that way?
Well, obviously, there's a judicial economy that we could argue if we're going to have answers submitted late...
But we've already got excusable neglect. We've got a trial court judge that says, hey, you neglected it, but it's excusable, so you're okay.
But isn't there a suspicion that excusable neglect, even when granted, is something that covers probably a weak defense in the first place? Maybe not.
No, doesn't say anything about the merits of the defense. It merely says it was... delay, didn't meet the requirements, and there's a good reason for it.
Well, if we didn't have the Dudzinski case, maybe we wouldn't be here. I don't know. But
well, I'm just asking you to give us a... I sit here, and as I was reading this case a few days ago, and I'm thinking, well, you know, why did they ever require this? Why not just let it, once excusable neglect has been established, why not just... Let them plead, give an answer, and let summary judgments take its course. Once a trial judge has told me that it's excusable that you didn't file an answer, why not let them file an answer in the normal course? But, I mean, this is my home run pitch to you. You can hit a home run on this one if you want.
Well, I don't know if I can hit a home run. I defer to what I've seen in so many other cases in other jurisdictions and federal interpretations of a Rule 60B.
Yeah, but that's sort of like saying that's the way we've always done it. I didn't accept that answer when I was a kid, and I don't accept it on the court.
Well,
and he accepts precedent.
But I will accept precedent, right. I mean, apparently all you've got to rely on is precedent, Dudzinski.
Well, in the federal case,
yeah.
How about your legislative history arguments, judicial council committee notes that talk about the change of the statute? Is that something you rely on or not? The change of the statute, the change of the statute, the committee notes say that we're supposed to follow the federal legislation.
I don't believe I presented that argument in my brief, and I'm not aware of any.
Well, when they adopted, and this is a rule, it's not a statute, I think it's adopted by this court. When we adopted it, the Judicial Council notes, and the Judicial Council proposed it, it said that we're following, substantially relying on Rule 60B?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did make some reference to that in my brief. I apologize.
Page?
On page 11 on my brief, I indicate the Judicial Council Committee Notes of 1974, and I quoted, where a Wisconsin rule of civil procedure is based on a federal rule of civil procedure, decisions of the federal court, to the extent they show a pattern of construction, are considered persuasive authority. That doesn't speak directly to the point, but it does make reference to 60B, and that it was consistent with 60B, which at that time required meritorious defense.
I don't know if you cited this, but here's the Nylon case, N-E-Y-L-A-N, which says the Judicial Council Committee notes states that 80607 stats is substantially equivalent to Federal Rule 60B and replaces 269. There is no suggestion that the committee intended a departure from former Wisconsin law, which is consistent with present federal cases
construing Federal Rule 60B, that Nylon case that incorporates the Judicial Committee notes and says that's, I mean, as I interpret it, that's what we're supposed to follow.
That was a 1985 case. You got it on the top of page 11.
Yes. And there are also a couple of cases that were cited with it, but Nylon was the direct authority in that.
1985 case of this court. So do you want to rely on that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, although the federal courts seem, many of them, seem to say that you need a meritorious defense, I don't know that they're all consistent in how they define what's a meritorious defense. What are our choices here?
Well, I think...
Look at the federal courts. Since the history of this rule, 806-07, says it looks like we're not really changing the prior law, which required meritorious defense, and we're looking to the federal rule 60B, which is what our prior law was. How do you define meritorious defense and give us a range? I mean, you're obviously going in for the toughest one. It's almost impossible to prove.
Well, you have to have something in terms of fact supporting your defense that would make someone conclude that there's an opportunity for more than a hint, that there's a reliable opportunity that you can succeed with that defense. Something has to be stated clearly. Something has to be stated factually.
Well, now, in this case, one of the defenses is that the product didn't work. And we're assuming that perhaps it did work, or that's just an inappropriate defense. But how would the court know otherwise if that's what you're talking about, a meritorious defense?
Well, if the product didn't work, they would have designated some form of repair that was necessary, some form of notice they had given to the vendor.
Which you said they didn't give.
Which they didn't give. And their affidavits were filed in 1966, July of 1966 or August, some 8 months after the product had been received. It was received in December of 1995, according to Phillips's affidavit and the complaint. And yet there's not one letter, one piece of document or communication whatsoever that indicated there was a problem with it.
What I'm getting at is that you have a standard of meritorious defense, and this is it, and this basically turns into a mini trial.
By affidavit at
that time.
If it turns into a trial by affidavit and there's a reasonable basis that's supported by some fact, the judge then would grant the motion to vacate.
Well, now, the circuit court here did look at the merits, didn't it?
Yes.
And circuit court, on the basis of what was presented to it, said these defenses don't hold water.
More or less.
How more and how less?
Well, he was looking for something to support the defenses in the form of the affidavits that were presented, and none of the affidavits dealt with any of the defenses. They were solely based on the issue of neglect and on the issue of the defendant's inability to pay.
I thought the trial court went further and said, look, on the basis of your answer, the wrong name doesn't mean much to me. The bankruptcy issue doesn't mean much. How can you mitigate here when you're dealing with a contract claim that's on its face was what, for a purchase price?
Right.
And so he went through at least some of these and said they don't wash. Is that what you think the trial court should do?
Yes.
Even though there was no affidavits, as you stated, putting these facts in?
Well, the trial court had nothing to deal with other than the bald, open answer. And it didn't feel that the answer adequately portrayed sufficient basis underlying any of those defenses to allow them to go forward.
But isn't that, I'm just thinking, that's normally what you get in a case. You have a complaint, you have an answer, we have bare bones pleadings, and now we're going to set up a special requirement because, as you indicated in your analogy to your children, that what happens after 11 o'clock requires more of an explanation than what happened before 11 o'clock. And I'm just indicating that, or concerned that when we write this case, or whoever on this court, what the standard we're setting will be for all of these cases that have excusable neglect or inadvertence, and we're going to expect them to have a, quote, meritorious defense. And that's what troubles me, is just how we're going to characterize this and what judges, trial judges, are going to have to look for, what they're going to be expected to do as far as finding whether or not this is meritorious.
I think that the trial court would accept that responsibility, and that the parties would then be required to present some factual basis, some document in support of their position, because the default judgment can be overturned if there's a factual basis and a legitimate legal argument with it to overturn that. Otherwise, if you go the other way, then you've just done away with the 20-day requirement to answer. And you've watered that down by saying, oh, don't worry about it. You can move to vacate, and as long as you show excusable neglect, we'll let you go.
But it isn't that easy to show. In other words, it's a, I think, an unusual case that you would be able to just say, well, inadvertence, excusable neglect, the cat knocked the, you know, the complaint off the piano. As I remember, I had one, and they came in 3 months later that they did find it when they
right.
cleaned up. But most of the time, the judge examines this, and I think that there are a sufficient criteria that they expect people to answer in time. I mean, it isn't automatic that you're getting excusable neglect. Would you agree that, or disagree with the fact that it's not something that's automatically granted
right.
by the court?
And excusable neglect is oftentimes not allowed when there's a lawyer in the picture who just inadvertently puts the file underneath a pile of work. He can't get away with that in this state, and I'm not sure in other states as well. But where the Wisconsin Supreme Court was interested in overturning things were the two cases cited by the Court of Appeals when they certified this case up here. Was they were cognovit note cases. And we know where the cognovit notes have gone. They don't exist anymore. And so they were, that was certainly something that you wanted to examine more carefully and more willing to vacate the judgment on than your ordinary, if there is such a word, ordinary default judgment. That's correct.
On both issues, namely excusable neglect and whether or not a meritorious defense was set forth?
I'm certain on the second, yes.
Thank you. I have a question. How's this?
the offer, you indicate that the factual basis, you need a factual basis. That's what your assertion is. In order to constitute a meritorious defense, you make reference to the language following your opposing counsel's comment of Mulwood, and that seems pretty heavy, a clear and specific statement showing, not by conclusion, but by definite recitation of facts, that an injustice has been probably done by the judgment. Something that's a little less than that might be the factual basis need not be stated with precision or unnecessary detail, but by a sufficient statement of facts to warrant an inference of a meritorious defense. Now that's less. What's your response to something like that? To warrant a sufficient facts to warrant an inference?
I certainly could live with that. I think that whether you warrant an inference or whether you are asking for strong facts supporting it so that it's reasonable to conclude that they might succeed is a step beyond that. And that in either case, you have to have something other than your plain old-fashioned denial and a statement of opinion or a proposition for defective equipment without alluding to where the equipment was deficient or how the defect related to its use in some fashion. Whether you do it by inference or whether you do it by the more strict conclusion, you're still going to be looking at the facts underlying whatever it is asserted to determine your answer.
Let me tell you one of my concerns. We have what I consider pretty hard and fast rules in terms of what a trial court must do when looking at a motion for judgment on the pleadings. You look at both sides of the pleadings and you see whether or not even construing, for example, the answer in a light most favorable to the defendant, there's any defense even asserted that fits the complaint. We know what the standards are for summary judgment. Now, I look at the judge's oral ruling here, and it appears that he's sort of commenting on what the lawyers have said in front of him, and he talks about, well, just, you know, the fact that there may be financial trouble for this corporation doesn't appear to me that it would be, that that's a reason not to have to pay the bills. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he's sort of summarizing based on what I think the lawyers have argued to him earlier. There is an analysis of denial, what does it mean versus the allegations. There's no analysis of erroneous party or mitigation of damages. And that's my concern. What standard should a trial judge use? Should it just be the lawyer sort of asserting what the complaint is and what the defense is? Should it be the standards of summary judgment as to whether or not there's a issue of fact or law to be tried? I mean, what standard are you advocating?
Well, the standard is one that would require a review of something beyond the...
What's the something? What's the something?
A factual assertion? A factual...
So a lawyer putting on a... Just typing up, these are our assertions in the lawsuit would be sufficient?
We're talking about vacating a default judgment.
I understand. I mean, I'm just trying to understand what it is, what standard it is that you think that this court ought to... You know, I'm not arguing with you, but I just, if a lawyer simply puts, these are our assertions on, we are denying the complaint because based on our information, and then they just list everything that they have within their information at that point, is that the standard? You're not requiring affidavit. You don't think affidavits are needed.
I think the affidavits are necessary. And I think affidavits, if they had existed, we wouldn't be here. If the
defendants put in affidavits and the plaintiffs believe the affidavits are erroneous, are the plaintiffs going to be able to put counter affidavits in? Or should the trial court simply accept the affidavits and based upon the affidavits find that there's a meritorious defense asserted?
Well, I think there will be some trial courts that might consider a counter affidavit if that affidavit was so, if the original affidavit was so far afield. You certainly would be entitled to counter it with something and establish, here's the document here that he says doesn't exist, or something of that nature.
Then is it a summary judgment analysis as to whether or not...
To that extent, it may be.
Okay.
What's your authority for that? Do you have any federal or state cases that say that it's a summary judgment?
No.
For the federal cases, do any of them set up a standard? I'm just trying to figure out, you know, parameters of, because if you say to trial courts, you have to determine whether there are meritorious defenses, and it is more than simply looking at the answer and deciding that there's a defense that would overcome a motion for judgment on the pleadings, but what more does a trial court have to look at? And I'm trying to find some standards as to, do any of the cases have standards other than sort of hints of merit or those kinds of that kind of language?
Well, there's some Seventh Circuit cases that indicate that you've got to have a reasonable basis and that...
And what's the standard of analysis for the trial court under those cases?
The standard in reviewing it is that no reasonable person would agree with that. So consequently, he has to have a fairly strong basis in denying the motion to vacate.
Well, there's a standard that says a meritorious defense is one which sets forth specific and sufficiently detailed facts which, if proven, would have resulted in a judgment different from the one entered.
That's right.
That's like our reversal on the grounds of an injustice having been done. You have to indicate that there are facts that wouldn't be sufficient for reversal. That's pretty stiff, isn't it?
It is. And if you notice the complaint in our case, it has attached to it the order or the contract as a part of the complaint, as Exhibit A to the complaint. And it's a one-page document drafted by Mr. Phillips, obviously. It's on his stationery. And the two men signing and dating it at the bottom. Now, that's pretty clear and unambiguous document that if you're going to come in after the fact to try to attack, it seems to me, you've got to have a bigger burden. And in order to get the door opened.
Well, there's a 1901 Wisconsin case, Gore v. Smith, that requires that the moving papers, including a proposed answer, show that the party has a good defense. Is that a good enough standard?
Well, I would accept that. There's a case involving a note between husband and wife, or ex-husband and ex-wife, called Wisolewski, that was cited by the Court of Appeals on its certification. That's 30 Wisconsin 2nd, 15. And there was a promissory note that was clear and unambiguous. And then the party trying to overturn or vacate the judgment said it wasn't the intention of the parties to sign that note or to execute that document. And the court said there's no allegation that the note was by mutual mistake of the party, nor is there any relief sought by way of reformation of the note. Such an answer fails to state a defense. That case is pretty clear that when you've got a document that you're relying on in a contract case, and it's clear and unambiguous, you better come in with something stronger than saying, I deny that it exists, there was a defect, wrong party named, or whatever.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is expired.
Thank you.
Ms. Lazar, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to point out that there was another case that mentioned the hint of a suggestion in the federal courts, and it also included a standard which could be used and might possibly should be used in determining what a meritorious defense is, and that's INVEST. It's INVST, INVEST versus Chem Nuclear. It's at 815 F. 2nd 391. And I reference it and the long definition at pages 4 and 5 in my reply brief. And that case indicates that in determining whether a defaulted defendant has a meritorious defense, likelihood of success is not the measure. Rather, if any defense relied upon states a defense good at law, then a meritorious defense has been advanced. The court continues to say that such a defense is sufficient if it contains even a hint of a suggestion which proven at trial would constitute a complete defense. And then they cite Wright and Miller, Federal Practice and Procedure, and say, the key consideration is to determine whether there is some possibility that the outcome of the suit after a full trial will be contrary to the result achieved by default. So that's a case that also mentioned the hint of a suggestion and sets forth a standard. To back up a step, we look again at the statute and the comments that meritorious defense has been taken out of the statute, so it may be that excusable neglect is enough because you are putting forward, you're giving that person an opportunity to go to the court and say there's a reason why no answer was filed. If the court determines there's a reason why no answer was filed, then the court should say you may file an answer. If you make the court at that point look at the answer and try to determine whether that answer has a meritorious defense or it's valid, or you require that affidavits be submitted, well, then you're saying that it's going to be a summary judgment motion. And you're telling the people that at the start of a case, if you go in 5 days after a default judgment, which means 25 days possibly after the complaint has been filed, you want the defendant to walk in and say, here are all my reasons and all the facts why this complaint is not, why I have a valid defense to this complaint. If you have a case such as, again, my trade secrets case, what if they allege a trade secret that's highly technical? Then the defendant is stuck having to say, well, it's not technical, and it's not a trade secret, and it's not a valid argument, but all I can tell you is that's upon my information and belief. I'm going to have to go out and get experts. Well, you can't require this defendant at that early stage of the game